You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. The Radio Cafe is brought to you by the City of Santa Fe Water Conservation. As you know, if you're living here in Santa Fe, we had a warm winter and we didn't get enough snow. The snow brings the water we need, and as a result, New Mexico's drought is currently among the worst in the United States. As the summer heats up, water restrictions in Santa Fe will be coming into effect, and we're being called upon to renew our conservation efforts and learn more about what we can do to value our water. Visit facebook.com/SaveWaterSantaFe to take the City of Santa Fe's new drought online quiz and learn not just about the current condition of the drought, but also how to contribute to long-term efforts to maintain a healthy, green, and water-wise Santa Fe. I'm very happy to introduce Jason Stanley. He's a professor of philosophy at Yale University. He's the author of several books. His new book is called How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Welcome.
Thank you for having me on the show.
So your book is a highly readable and relatively short book. It can be read by really anybody, and it's a description of the characteristics of fascism, including things that we'll talk about, like ultra-nationalism, inequality, propaganda. First of all, just briefly, what prompted you to write this book?
Well, I think most Americans don't realize that our democracy is always warring between very sort of valuable liberal impulses and fascist impulses. And what we're seeing today, I wanted to emphasize, is not something completely foreign to us. It's not some invasion from Europe. We have fascist elements in our politics and always have had fascist elements in our politics. And so I wanted to write this book to remind people that this is a struggle that we're always going to have. And we need to recognize, as it were, the darker angels of our nature.
So let's talk about some of the elements of fascism. One piece is a mythologized history that whitewashes the actual past. Give us an example of this.
Well, it's like the history I grew up with as a child when I was told that the black Americans had the vote taken away from them after Reconstruction because black governments, majority black governments, were corrupt. It's the kind of fake history you often get in the United States surrounding slavery. That the Civil War wasn't about slavery, it was about states' rights. Of course, states' rights was the right to enslave others. But and across the world, you find politicians posing these sort of fake histories. So whenever you have these far-right ultranationalist parties, they invariably run on this idea that in the past our country was great, and this greatness was taken away from us by liberalism, by compromise, by weakness. We're seeing it in Hungary today, when Orbán talks about when Hungary was great and defended and greater Hungary and how this was taken away from Hungarians. We see it in Turkey when Erdogan talks about the Ottoman Empire and the greatness of the Ottoman Empire, how this was taken away. We see it in Russia with Vladimir Putin. A lot of Putin's politics involves lamenting the loss of Russian territory and Russian greatness. Germany, of course, National Socialism. You know, Germany was great, and then Versailles destroyed Germany, and they lost land. And, you know, so what you do in this kind of politics is you connect people's feelings of loss and loss of status and anxiety with a myth, with this idea that there was this incredible past where they were just admired just for having their nationality and for being men. The mythic past is always patriarchal. It's always a past where men were men and women stayed at home and had traditional gender roles. And what you do is you connect people's sense of anxiety, sense of nervousness about the future with nostalgia. You tell them your anxiety and fear is due to the fact that in the past, you got adulation and appreciation just for having your skin color, just for having your gender, and now you're not getting proper adulation, and we're going to return that to you.
I think about the when I read that section about the Texas school textbooks that refer to slaves as workers and talk about how they were, some of them were very well treated. And then earlier this month, the Texas Board of Education voted to literally erase both Hillary Clinton and Helen Keller and some others from history. Would you call that fascism or kind of proto-fascism?
Well, fascist politics and ideology is 10 elements that I lay out in my book. Certainly, it is a clear marker of fascist politics and ideology, the way it manipulates and erases the past. In fascist ideology, there is only one past, and that's the past of the dominant group. It's only the past, it's only the perspective of wars, of men, of the chosen members of the nation. So the Texas debate is only the latest in the long battleground that has been our education system. Our education system has long been at the heart of these battles about the past, where nationalists want to create a fake narrative, where there's only one perspective. Because in fact, the past, there were lots of people living in the past. There were women, there were Black Americans, there were Native Americans. So the past would be all of their perspectives. But what you find feeding fascism, I mean, I wouldn't say it's completely identical to fascism, but without an accurate history, without an accurate understanding of all perspectives in the past, you leave yourself terribly vulnerable to fascist politicians, because then you buy their narrative of past greatness. So while you do have non-fascist nationalists who think that in the education system we should glorify the past rather than representing it accurately, it's a terrible problem in a democracy if you grow up with that education.
Well, I was going to ask you if there has to be some grain of truth in these mythic histories in order for them to take hold in the minds of people. But some of the examples you're giving are the exact opposite of the truth. And you talked about this concept of corruption. Fascists come in often on a platform of anti-corruption, and yet they are so corrupt themselves. What is their concept of corruption?
Fascist corruption is corruption of the traditional order, usurpation of the traditional hierarchical order. The ideology of fascism is based on power, loyalty, and hierarchy. The idea is you've got an authoritarian leader, they're the leader of the dominant group, men are ranked ahead of women, one racial group or religious group is ranked ahead of others. You have hierarchy and authority, and at the top is the fascist leader. So corruption means inverting that hierarchy, corrupting that hierarchy. So fascism is a politics of purity. You know, you pure race. Hitler is very clear about the demand for pure race. The United States has a very brutal past in its immigration policies, a past that Hitler admired, of keeping immigration racially pure to Northern Europeans. So fascism creates this idea of purity. And then the idea is that foreigners or non-whites or women gaining power, that challenges the sort of pure fascist image of the traditional family and the man as the warrior and wage earner, the woman as the stay-at-home homemaker. Corruption means corruption of that by foreign elements, by liberals, by decadence.
By women.
By women. And so Kate Mann, in her wonderful book, Down Girl, makes the point. She emphasizes the gender aspect, that how was President Trump able to run an anti-corruption campaign against Hillary Clinton? You know, President Trump had a long history of problematic business dealings and clearly potentially corrupt or corrupt business dealings. How was he able to do that? Because the idea of a woman inverting the hierarchy is corrupt.
So this is so interesting to me because in my lifetime, certainly, conservative politics in the U.S. has been very much rooted in these kind of polarized gender roles. It's been very anti-feminist, anti-gay, all these things having to do with gender and sexuality. It's been defined by strength in a kind of masculine way, military strength. I mean, during the Reagan era, there was a woman named Phyllis Schlafly, who made a career of telling women they shouldn't have careers. How do you make the distinction between fascist ideas on gender and those of U.S. conservatism over the last, let's say, 4 or 5 decades?
Excellent. Let me just note that Phyllis Schlafly was also deeply involved in education system and criticizing education systems. My previous book on propaganda, I talk about Schlafly's role in attacking education systems for not just constraining their offerings to the dominant perspective. So these things are linked. Now, to your question about the relationship between the standard conservative politics or various forms of standard conservative politics and fascist politics, well, I mean, people ask me, did you write this book because of Trump? No, I wrote this book because of the United States. Standard social conservatism is not fascism any more than Bernie Sanders is a communist. However, there are gradations, and the gender politics of social conservatism is shared by fascist politicians. The thing is that fascism is the extreme of a spectrum, and fascism is the extreme of the right-wing spectrum. Fascism is harshly patriarchal. It has all the gendered elements of conservative, some conservative politics, but much more so. But it adds other elements. So while social conservatives are a legitimate part of our democratic deliberation, libertarians are a legitimate part of our democratic deliberation, there become times when people form in units to battle a perceived enemy, and they end up aligning themselves in constellations which are much more dangerous than positions that I disagree with, because I am a staunch critic of some of the social conservative positions on gender. But I think that, nevertheless, those are democratically legitimate positions. But the problem is, in certain times when they link with more extremist views, you know, you get a fascist constellation of views. So that's, I think, a problem. And I think it's a problem that we increasingly or regularly face in the United States. I mean, after all, think of Pat Buchanan's run in 1992. Pat Buchanan was pushing close to fascist politics.
What was he saying?
Well, he was being harshly nationalistic. He had some of the anti-immigration lines. He had the extreme social conservative lines on gender equality. He was talking about themes like decadence, liberal decadence, decline of the nation, decline of traditional values. And, you know, it's okay to be concerned about decline of traditional values. That's an acceptable position, just as it's a democratically acceptable position to be a cosmopolitan who finds traditional gender norms problematic and discriminatory. But he was doing some of the anti-immigration stuff, some of the politics of purity that tilts us, some of the heartland versus cosmopolitanism that is reminiscent of the kind of European fascist politics that I critique in my book. And we also have this history with the Ku Klux Klan. Nancy MacLean's book, Behind the Mask of Chivalry, about the Ku Klux Klan, I mean the title, Behind the Mask of Chivalry, It's about how the Ku Klux Klan was all about, represented itself as protecting the traditional family against liberals, communists, Jews, and black and alleged black rapists.
You know, one of the weirdest things to me right now is you see this kind of politics, this us and them tendency in the so-called American heartland. Us is supposedly the wholesome countryside. I mean, you write about this, the kind of pure rural and then the decadent cities. But there are few people on this earth more overtly urban and decadent than our current president. And yet he's gained their support.
Right. That's because he's practicing fascist politics. There were few people less blonde and blue-eyed than Adolf Hitler.
Right.
Fascism trades off illusion. There was an interesting phone conversation between President Trump and Prime Minister Trumbull of Australia, where President Trump showed his cards, I think, a bit. But Australia, which also has very harsh policies towards immigrants, had a policy of turning back all boats, refugees coming on boats, because they were trying to discourage refugees from coming on boats. And President Trump said on this phone conversation, "You're even worse than I am."
Right.
Meaning that President Trump knows that his immigration rhetoric, his harshly dehumanizing, horrific immigration rhetoric, is bad.
Right.
Is meant to incite and gain support.
Still another piece of fascist ideology is a kind of Orwellian thing. It's the sense of victimhood by the dominant group, the group that's actually in power, which claims that it's being victimized by the group that is actually oppressing. What are some historical examples of this? How do we see this in American society?
Well, I think the clearest example is the men's rights movement.
Right.
I talk about Kate Mann's work and the work of others on this topic. The idea that encroaching women's equality is actually victimization of men. So we find this theme, I mean, this is very familiar to us from our current politics, but we find it throughout Hitler in Mein Kampf is always talking about how the Germans are incredibly victimized, how, you know, Germans, ethnic Germans in other countries are the most victimized people. Fascism is a politics of victimization where the dominant group is history's greatest victims. Viktor Orban had a conference, the International Conference for the Persecution of Christians in Budapest in 2017, where he said Christians are the most persecuted religious group in the world. President Trump ran saying Christians, you'll be able to say Merry Christmas again, as if in a country where Christianity is by far the vastly dominant religion, you could ever not say Merry Christmas. The Hindutva movement in India, they're constantly talking about how the Muslim minority is persecuting them. You know, they once had this great pure Hindu past that is being ruined by the presence of Muslims and liberals. So you know that fascist politics is taking hold when you have, for example, white Christian men in America saying they're the most persecuted group.
Right. And I think one thing that this kind of thinking does is that it draws false lines so that where, for example, racial politics are concerned, you have this illusion that a poor white person has more in common with a Wall Street banker than he does with his poor black coworker or neighbor. Explain that racially divisive aspect of fascism and how it plays into things like the attack on labor unions.
Right. This is crucial. So this is one thing I found surprising in my research, that across the literature, so in the literature, for instance, W.E.B. Du Bois's masterwork, Black Reconstruction, you find this theme, the theme of labor unions. You find it in Arendt, the importance of labor unions in the fight against fascism. Du Bois talks about the importance of labor unions in the fight against racism. And of course, if you think about the poem on the side of the U.S. Holocaust Museum by Martin Niemöller, you see the targets of fascism. First they came for the communists, then they came for the Jews, then they came for the trade unionists. So we know that labor unions are this enormous target in fascist politics. Why? Labor unions are an enormous target in fascist politics because labor unions create groups of people who identify for class reasons. And what fascism seeks is groups of people who identify along fictional lines like racial reasons or, you know, perhaps less fictional lines of religious reasons or ethnic reasons. It seeks to erase people identifying across racial divides and unify them along the fascist us them distinction of race, ethnicity, ultranationalism. Du Bois has this notion he calls the psychological wages of whiteness. The psychological wages of whiteness. And what he means by that is that wealthy northern industrialists and the white planter class in the South were able to stop a growing labor movement that was unifying poor whites and poor blacks by reminding poor whites of the psychological wages of whiteness, that just their whiteness alone gave them a status that was priceless. And so you find this politics all over the United States. When poor white Americans talk about sacrificing their own health insurance so that the, quote, undeserved, unquote, don't get health insurance, what do they mean? They mean that they would rather die of an illness, a treatable illness, than see some non-white person get health insurance. People will literally sacrifice themselves with happiness to retain their racial dignity. And what labor unions do is they create bonds that link us together across those divides. And that's why I say in Wisconsin, for example, Scott Walker smashed the labor unions.
Right, exactly. And it gets you thinking, first of all, I mean, there have been many books written about reasons why people vote against their own self-interest, for example, and certainly voting against your own health insurance or being willing to sacrifice that is so extreme. And for what? I mean,
for the psychological wages of whiteness.
The psychological waves of whiteness, is that, I mean, it's really hard to understand, like the psychological whiteness versus cancer treatment.
Exactly. But history, unfortunately, tells us that fascist leaders, people who practice fascist politics, are able to repeatedly harm the material interests of their own supporters, repeatedly rob and steal from them, and just increase their popularity by doubling down on the harsh rhetoric.
Now, does economic equality, let's say you have stronger labor unions, let's say you have higher minimum wages, let's say you have the things like the safety net and stuff like that that other countries have, does that serve as a kind of inoculation against fascism?
It does to some extent, because in those cases, people feel less anxiety and fear about the future. So Hannah Arendt talks about fascism requiring people to be atomized. Fascism requires people to feel afraid. And one reason for people to feel afraid is economic fear. So you create this economic fear. What you do in fascist politics is you create a zero-sum politics. You say, there's just one pie, and more for women, more for immigrants is less for you. And then if people already have economic fear, then that will make them feel even more afraid. And then you can blame their economic situation on people who are coming to take slices of the pie, when in fact you can actually just bake a bigger pie with more immigrants, for example. But we also can't forget that across the world today, we're seeing many countries that don't face economic problems fall for fascist ultranationalism. So, for example, in Poland, the Civic Platform expanded Poland's GDP, but yet, by appealing to ultranationalism, Law and Justice Party was able to come to power and dismantle liberal democratic institutions by appealing to virulent nationalism. Poland's a country where 60,000 people recently marched through the streets of Warsaw chanting pure blood.
Another feature of fascist regimes, as you've talked about, is the idea of a strong man, always a man, a leader who has a kind of mystique around him. And one of the things he does is he attacks institutions like universities and the media for basically for their truth-telling tendencies. And so instead of truth arrived at through things like research and reporting and science, the strong man and his circle prefer propaganda, which plays on some of the things that we've talked about, like mythic history, gender roles, racism, and so on. Explain the difference between a propaganda media outlet and a genuine media outlet, because we have kind of both of those things really competing with each other here in the U.S.
We do. So you always have fascist politicians attacking the mainstream media. Hitler attacked the Lügenpresse and Goebbels, the lying press. And there's a very particular strategy that's used. The particular strategy is to say that the mainstream media is part of a conspiracy. So fascist politics always involves conspiracy theories. Like when birtherism came into the political consciousness in the United States, I began to be very worried. My first piece in the mainstream press was on birtherism in 2011. Because that's a terrible sign. And there's a trap you do. The trap is you say, the media isn't reporting on this conspiracy, therefore the media is part of the conspiracy.
Right.
So Hitler said, the media is owned by Jews, and you can tell because the media doesn't report that it's owned by Jews. Similarly, Mr. Trump in 2011 and 2012 said, Obama and the leftists control the media, and you can tell because they're not reporting on birtherism. But if the media does start to report on the wacky conspiracy theories, then it gives them credence. It gives them a certain kind of legitimacy that they shouldn't have. So that's the trap for the mainstream media. What we have now is we have a state propaganda arm, in the case of Fox News, that simply creates a whole new vision of what is important. So it's like our discussion of history earlier in the broadcast when we talked about how there's a problematic anti-democratic way of teaching history. You only teach one perspective. So what we find is when you watch Fox News, the only thing that's important is what threatens President Trump from the Mueller investigation or from various aspects of his presidency that are legitimately concerning. But it's tricky, right? Because the Fox News viewer is going to say the mainstream press is only giving you one perspective. And that's why truth is very important. though it's tricky because the mainstream press can't report on everything. So the Fox News viewer can say, look, the mainstream press isn't reporting on the things we find important. Of course, some of the things they find important, like QAnon conspiracy theories or phantom waves of immigrants creating crime waves, are just false. And other things are distorted. So, for example, immigrants, in fact, have considerably lower violent crime rates than native-born Americans. But if you just repeatedly show immigrant crime, you make people think that immigrants have higher crime rates. So there's ways of, so this is a whole other topic, how propaganda works. That was the subject of my previous book, How Propaganda Works.
Well, I mean, I think it's important to challenge the notion that there is a parallel between the so-called right and left with respect to their media. I mean, you quote Stephen Bannon as saying that the words that won the 2016 election were drain the swamp, lock her up, build a wall. Meanwhile, the other side, the mainstream media like the New York Times, the Washington Post, and respected newspapers that are certainly worthy of plenty of critique. They're not perfect. Nobody's perfect in the media. And they all have certain perspectives and perhaps even biases. But that other side, that mainstream side, was, I think, attempting to represent issues in a more complex and reality-based ways and had certain standards of reporting. So the two sides aren't really parallel. And the side that's more complex doesn't want to fight propaganda with more propaganda.
That's right. Excellent. I completely agree with you. What you find in a lot of the right-wing media is, frankly, panic and hysteria. The aim of reporting is to create fear and then create loyalty, whereas the aim of a lot of mainstream reporting is not that. I mean, I think the mainstream media really has screwed up in the past with creating panicked fear when it shouldn't have, for instance, in the run-up to the Iraq War, issues in the 90s surrounding mass incarceration. But if you show lurid crime stories about immigrants when, in fact, immigrants have lower crime rates, what you're doing is you're trying to create baseless panic and fear. And that's just a lot easier to consume. It's an easier narrative, good guys, bad guys, than the more complex narrative that you find in the mainstream media. And so we find this again and again in discussions of fascism in the past. Arendt says, fascism seeks to turn the news into spectacle. And so it's about entertainment. So emotion, like you feel fear and then you feel, there's the good guy who's going to protect me. But that's not democratic politics. Democratic politics is the difficulty of weighing different perspectives and compromise and the complexity of policy. But when you transform the news into entertainment, no wonder you're going to get a strongman entertainer as your leader.
So what's the proper and effective response to propaganda?
To this kind of propaganda? What's the proper effective response to the situation we find ourselves in, where people are glued, there's constant excitement. So Arendt tells us that under fascist administrations and authoritarianism generally, communism too, there's always this excitement around who's in, who's out, who's being deposed now. There's a constant churn in the news, and people get addicted to that excitement. You know, frankly, people, I think, thought it would be boring to have Secretary Clinton as president. She sticks to the facts, you know, she's policy wonkish. So when people get this feeling that reality should be like entertainment, that's very dangerous for democracy. So how to return people to boring news, to focus on, I get concerned about outrage on both sides because the kind of constant feeling of fear, the kind of constant churn and spectacle, if politics gets reduced to that, it's not clear how we're going to return to two fairly boring people who disagree about the tax rate debating.
Right.
So unfortunately, I don't know how to get people unhooked from the kind of excitement junking that's going on in our media today. I wish I had a solution.
Well, you write about Plato's Republic, Book 8, in which he explains how democracy leads to tyranny. And it suggests...
Well, he argues.
Or argues. And it really suggests that there is kind of a, almost like a cycle of history. Is that true? Do you think there are historical cycles of fascism and democracy and tyranny and so on that repeat and need to somehow play themselves out?
Deep, very great question. Fascism in its current form requires the 19th century. Modern fascism requires nationalism and ultranationalism, which really gets philosophically perfected in the 19th century. But elements of fascism are familiar to human societies, and you can see this from Book 8 of Plato's Republic, when he talks about democracy leading directly to tyranny because freedom of speech will allow someone to come and raise panic and fear about one group in society and represent themselves as the only person who can protect their supporters from this group that he's vilified. And then when he comes into power, he'll end democracy and become a tyrant. That's Plato's argument. So that suggests that democracy is always vulnerable. Now, we have to remember that very few societies have ever been democratic, have ever had liberal democracy. It's very new, because most people accepted Plato's argument. Rousseau, who argues for democracy in The Social Contract, says the reason people think democracy won't work is because they haven't thought of societies that don't have grounds for resentment. Rousseau argued that liberal democracy will work if you create a society in which people aren't resentful of each other. And what that means is they don't have racial resentments, gender resentments, economic resentments. What that means is that there's large-scale equality. And in conditions of large-scale equality, people won't feel resentful of each other for their skin color. They're not going to feel robbed of something. They're not going to feel resentful of people because of large gaps in wealth. So Rousseau argues liberal democracy is only possible under conditions where people don't feel so afraid. The problem is, if you look at the history of political philosophy, people say when people feel afraid, when people feel like they're lonely, they're losing their status, they're losing their traditions, they turn to fascism, they turn to tyranny. So insofar as destabilization, loss of tradition is a permanent condition, a certain kind of liberal progress, you're always going to face this cycle of feelings of loss and a turn to tyranny and a strong man who will protect us from the liberal onslaught and liberalism. And historically, what we're looking at now looks a lot like what happened in the 1930s, because we have these ultra-nationalist, what I would call fascist movements, all over the world right now. India, in Brazil right now, South America has several of these all over Eastern Europe and Western Europe. So it suggests that, you know, we had women's rights advance in the last 20, 25 years. We had greater immigration, and we had greater respect for religious equality and toleration of sexual minorities. And at the same time, we had growing economic inequality. So that's a very dangerous mix. That's a very dangerous mix, because then you can have potential tyrants blaming people's anxiety about and resentment from growing economic inequality on liberalism.
Instead of blaming it on the place where it really belongs, which is...
the billionaire oligarchs who are funding the tyrant.
Exactly. Well, so fascism plays on people's fears, and as you write, empires in decline are particularly vulnerable to fascism. But I mean, a lot of people have fears and don't respond to them by buying into that kind of us and them thinking. I mean, people are scared of all kinds of things like global warming and nuclear annihilation and deep economic insecurity or collapse. What makes some people or some groups more susceptible and others not?
members of the dominant group who are the targeted supporters, the people the person practicing fascist politics targets with their tactics. This is the psychological wages of whiteness point. So, right, the economic anxiety argument for President Trump's support never holds much weight because plenty of poor white Americans, working white Americans, did not vote for Trump. His base was wealthier than that. And black Americans voted en masse against Trump. Black women voted in large, huge numbers against Trump. And black Americans were targeted harshly by they lost the most in the Great Recession. So they didn't turn into the arms of tyranny, if that's what President Trump represents, if that's what he's, I don't mean to call him a tyrant, I'm just saying he's practicing certain worrisome political tactics. So economic anxiety is not, what makes people susceptible to these kinds of us versus them politics. It's only part of the equation. The people in question need to be members of the dominant group, because fascism involves this kind of fake disillusion, the illusion that your skin color, your gender, just this gives you a certain kind of priceless dignity. So it's those people who are the targets of the politics, and it's those people whose economic anxiety can be translated and misdirected into support for a potential tyrant.
Once fascists gain power, does that inevitably lead to genocide or some other kind of mass killing?
Absolutely not. Hitler was uniquely bad. Mussolini did terrible things in Eritrea, but Mussolini was not anywhere near that bad. I mean, there are plenty of fascist movements that never resulted in mass genocide. Hitler took a certain ideology to its logical extreme. I mean, one of the bases of fascism is social Darwinism. So fascist politicians talk about winners and losers. They talk about makers and takers, like only winners have value, losers don't have any value. If you think about what the Nazis did with that, the T4 program, which was the gassing of the disabled, that's taking a certain ideology to its maximum logical extreme.
Yeah.
And you don't find many fascist movements doing that. But nevertheless, fascist politics conditions people to be okay with mass violence. So you can see the, say, family separation policies as an example of the kind of conditioning that happens when you're used to a certain kind of harsh rhetoric. Or you can find our lengthy treatment of black Americans as evidence for this. I mean, the harsh treatment of juvenile black men for crimes they did for which juvenile white men would never be punished.
Right. Do fascist regimes always collapse? I mean, are they inherently unstable? Do they have kind of a lifespan?
That's sort of the opposite of Plato's point. Do democratic regimes always collapse? Do they have a lifespan? But I don't think so. I think Putin has been in power forever. There's a succession problem with fascist regimes. You know, what happens when the fascist leader, any authoritarian regimes, communist regimes are the same way, extreme communist regimes, any authoritarian regime, monarchy, Stalinism, fascism, have a succession problem. So there's a succession problem, but the succession problem can be overcome by handing power over to family members as monarchy has practiced for generations. So one may suspect if President Trump were to be less democratic, if it were a worst case scenario, one could expect Ivanka Trump to be our first female president.
So I can see, as we've talked about, the ways that people get swayed by fascist propaganda, but what's in it for the insiders? Do they tend to be true believers? Are they cynical? Are they all about making money by soaking the taxpayers? How do you understand that?
Excellent. Yeah. Usually I say to this question, it doesn't matter. What I discovered in my research, people are always like, well, is President Trump does all these things, but is he really a fascist? Does President Trump really hate in the way that he talks sometimes? Does he really believe the things he sometimes says, for instance, about immigrant groups? I mean, President Trump is not an extreme example, I would say. There are worse examples like Orban or Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil right now. But do they believe their own propaganda? One thing that I found surprising was that even in the literature on National Socialism, which, as I indicated, is a very extreme example of the fascist movement that led to very extremely harsh, brutal policies, you find the same discussion. You find people saying, historians, as I talk about in How Fascism Works, in the literature on National Socialists, you find historians noting a lot of people think the Nazis were like committed, true believing, convinced anti-Semites, but a good number of them just wanted to steal Jewish property and art and couldn't care less, you know. So it's always the case that some people in these fascist movements, like compare, for instance, Poland and Hungary. I think Kaczynski is probably does believe that, you know, he is anointed by God to take over and run Poland on behalf of pure Polish blood. Orban, I think, is completely cynical and just wants to enrich himself. That's my suspicion. You find this with all the fascist movements, though. You find this historically with fascist movements, that they were composed both of true believers, as it were, and of people who are just cynically manipulating the tropes. I mean, if you look at when Russia turned anti-gay in its politics, it wasn't that long ago. They adopted certain political tactics in order to sort of enrage and sort of to use homophobia strategically.
So if the seeds of fascism are taking root in this country, if it is a dangerous moment for us, how do you think full-blown fascism can be avoided or prevented? Can it?
Well, I think one thing to note is that the seeds of fascism have always been in our country. Hitler's deeply influenced by the United States. The 1924 Immigration Act is something Hitler praises. He says the United States is a initial model for the national state he's arguing for in Germany. So the seeds of fascism have long been here, and we're always fighting it. And we can gain strength from the fact that we've always won, thanks to the civil rights movement, thanks to movements for gender equality, thanks to the gay rights movement, thanks to labor unions, thanks to working class white people, thanks to, you know, thanks to these multiple struggles, thanks to public school teachers, thanks to multiple groups of Republicans and Democrats, we fought off these forces that divide us in order to gain power. I think what we face now is a worry about a one-party state. In too many places, the Republicans are exhibiting what Hannah Arendt calls loyalty to party over parties, by which she means loyalty to their own political party over multi-party democracy. And that's extremely dangerous. So we have voter suppression, extreme voter suppression. We're on the verge of a hard right Supreme Court, not just a right wing Supreme Court, but a hard right Supreme Court appointed by a president who won a minority of votes. A minority of people voted for Republicans for Senate. The Senate is sort of an inherently problematic institution in that respect. So there's a worry about a one party state. But I think there's two important things to remember. First, we have our disagreements, but we should have commitment to there being Republicans and Democrats and respect each other and respect legitimate viewpoints and block these attempts to sort of destroy the multi-party system on behalf of just loyalty. And we faced these problems in the past. And, you know, the civil rights movement didn't take place in Vermont. It took place in Alabama. Those were Americans who went into a very frightening, dangerous place and face down injustice. And if they can do it there, then we can overcome whatever forces that face us in the future. I really believe that.
Jason Stanley is a professor of philosophy at Yale University. His new book is How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for the conversation.
You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.